Joining me now is Dr. David Stevenson, George Van Osdell Professor of Planetary Science at Caltech. His thesis work focused on the interior of Jupiter, and he's since branched out into studying all aspects of planets and large satellites. He's a fellow of the Royal Society and a member of the Solar System Exploration Subcommittee at NASA. I'm delighted to be talking with him today.
Thank you for inviting me.
I gather you're a fan of science fiction. Why?
As a young boy, I was fascinated by science fiction. I saw in those novels that I read by people such as Asimov, Fred Hoyle, Robert Heinlein, I saw their imagination at work and fascinating ideas about alternative realities. And to me, that was a window into the possibilities of science as well as just being fun. I believe that science itself requires imagination, and I've always felt that that makes science not as different as people sometimes suppose from doing art or music or writing books. A good example of that is the great English scientist Fred Hoyle, who was a very accomplished scientist but also wrote science fiction. And I could see the connections there between the imagination required to do the good science and the imagination required to do science fiction. Another wonderful example is Arthur C. Clarke. In his ideas about space stations, ideas about traveling to other parts of the solar system, 2001, Arthur C. Clarke was not quite as accomplished as a scientist, but he was a visionary, one of the great visionaries of the 20th century, somebody to admire, look up at.
What's significant about his scientific work, and how did it feed into his fiction?
I think that the ideas that Arthur C. Clarke had played a direct role in the storylines that he developed, for example, in 2001 with a spacecraft going to Jupiter, with the idea of a computer called HAL. These are things that were natural extensions of scientific ideas. So you could see how he was taking something that was scientifically plausible and extending it. Likewise with Fred Hoyle, although some of his ideas were more exotic there too, you could see the connection between the science he did and the science fiction that he was writing.
He was a critic of the Big Bang Theory, correct?
Fred Hoyle invented a theory called the Steady State Theory, in which the universe had no beginning. In a derisory way, he talked about the alternative as the Big Bang. And when he first used that phrase, he invented that phrase, he thought that he was criticizing it. But of course, people picked up on that. It was such a clever way of describing what happened at the beginning of the universe. In this instance, Fred Hoyle was almost certainly wrong. We think that the Big Bang Theory is, in fact, essentially correct, and the alternative of a steady-state universe does not agree with what we see.
I gather he was an influence on your own thinking.
One of the ways he influenced me is through his popularizations of science, not just through science fiction. He showed the unity of science. He showed, for example, that in thinking about how the Earth evolved, you needed to think about space. He talked, for example, about ice ages and the connection between what was happening here on Earth and what was happening in space. And we now know that the ice ages are influenced by the way that the Earth orbits around the sun. So his emphasis on the unity of science certainly had an impact on me. I did meet him later in life, got to know him a little bit. In his later life, he developed some ideas that were regarded as crazy. But that sometimes happens with scientists. That's okay.
Do scientists learn from science fiction?
I'm not sure that scientists really learn from science fiction, but they're certainly encouraged to use their imagination through science fiction. And on occasion, ideas that are developed for fictional purposes influence science. I know of one very good example of that. Carl Sagan, when he wrote Contact, which eventually became a movie, approached one of my colleagues at Caltech, Kip Thorne, about the idea of wormholes, about the idea that there could be a complicated geometry to space-time that allowed travel that seemed as though it was faster than the speed of light, but wasn't really faster than the speed of light. It involved, if you will, a shortcut. And Kip Thorne, famous astrophysicist, went away and did a calculation to see whether this was possible. So that's an example of where science fiction had a close interplay with science.
And what did he find out?
He found out that in principle it was possible. That is to say, wormholes did not violate the laws of physics as we know them. In practice, it might be exceedingly difficult. Another example of an interplay between fiction and reality could be the idea that is now widely accepted within physics, which is the possibility that there are additional dimensions to space-time beyond those that we see as human beings. We see three dimensions of space, one dimension of time. Current physical theory suggests that there may be other dimensions of a different kind that make up the full geometry of space-time. And of course, the idea of additional dimensions permeates science fiction.
You know, I'm very interested in your remark about the role of imagination and how widespread is that belief in the scientific community.
Some kinds of science rely very heavily on mathematical analysis using the existing principles that we understand well, and that can be highly technical. But some of the most important ideas in science come about through thinking out of the box, if you will, thinking about something different than what we currently understand. And that is where imagination comes in, a willingness to make connections between things that were previously not connected. In physics, we have seen this to some extent in the willingness of people to make a connection between the universe as a whole, which has an immense scale to it, and the behavior of space and time at the smallest possible scales, down at the level that we learn about through collisions of very high energy particles in particle accelerators. At one time, you would have thought that's ridiculous, that there should not be a connection between what happens at the largest scale and what happens at the smallest scale. But scientists have found that there is indeed a connection, and it required some imagination to see that a connection of that kind might exist.
We've just listened to War of the Worlds, and I want to talk about the relationship between science and fictional writing. What is your sense of the beginning of this? Why do writers like H.G. Wells and Jules Verne begin to write these kinds of stories at that particular time in history?
In the case of H.G. Wells and War of the Worlds, written in 1898, it would seem to me that he was motivated by several things. Certainly, he had a sense that there were developments likely in science that would change the nature of our existence. And he brought that into his stories through ideas that were technological advances. An example of that would be the idea of a spacecraft coming from Mars to the Earth and being shot off the surface of Mars, essentially, as you would fire a bullet out of a rifle. The idea of the Martians encasing themselves, essentially a symbiosis between robots and living organisms, which make up the tripods, these things that walk across the countryside in his story. That, too, is something that, in a sense, has come to pass. The idea of robots as being something that could be combined with human beings to do what you want to do when you go to another planet. And, of course, these days we rely on robotic exploration to understand other planets. We don't send ourselves there. We tend to send spacecraft. That idea is there in the work of Jules Verne and there in the work of H.G. Wells. I think also that in the case of H.G. Wells, as is often the case in science fiction, he was commenting on society and on the nature of the culture, the civilization that we live in. For indeed, at that time, as has happened later, there was a fear of invasion. In that particular instance, it was the fear of being invaded by Germany, which had become recently unified and was viewed as a powerful force in Europe. So he played on that fear of invasion by concocting this quite fantastic story about aliens from Mars, but making a comparison between the horrible things that these Martians were doing and the terrible things that some Europeans had done to other people elsewhere on Earth. So that was social commentary. And I would say that much of the great science fiction that has been written has that social commentary as an essential part of the plot. That's what makes a lot of science fiction so relevant to society and to thinking about the civilization in which we live. You see that in George Orwell's 1984. You see that in Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, which is a story about book burning, and so on. And to me, that's as interesting as the technological aspect of science fiction.
What is really happening with regard to exploring Mars? And is there any kind of a plan to try to put people on Mars anytime in the near future?
The main reason, as I see it, for going to a planet like Mars, sending spacecraft there, is to understand how planets work, how different environments work. It is curiosity-driven science. It's an exciting, a fascinating challenge to figure out how a planet like Mars evolved. Why is it different from the Earth? Why does it behave the way it does with volcanoes, with the possibility of water flowing in the past, with ice caps? Does it have life? Did it ever have life? Many of the motivations for space exploration, especially through NASA, are coming these days from this desire to understand habitability, to understand whether you can have life elsewhere than on Earth. Is it unusual to have life, or is it common in the universe? We hope to answer that question, and certainly going to a place like Mars is part of answering it. Now, as to sending people, the problem there, of course, is that it is so difficult to do it. And even if you could, and even if you did it, that would be a far cry from talking about colonization, because colonization implies that you change the environment of the planet to make it suitable for life. That has certainly been discussed. There are certainly people, visionary thinkers, who have wondered about how you could set up a colony that had a substantial number of people. To me, the effort required to do that is so enormous that I wonder whether it is a sensible goal. To me, the issue that we confront as scientists at present is very much here at home, making sure that the Earth is habitable. I don't think it makes any sense to talk about going to another planet having ruined our own. Far better to work on making our planet a sustainable environment. And that is going to be a hard problem. That will require a lot of resources. But the payoff is so much greater than the vision of solving this by sending people elsewhere.
Arthur Clarke was interested in Jupiter, and so are you. Why?
I think it's natural to be fascinated by Jupiter as the most massive planet in the solar system. So whenever we look at something, we have our attention drawn first to the biggest thing. Jupiter is more massive than all the other planets combined. But I think also that the presence of a set of satellites makes Jupiter fascinating, especially because there are four large satellites, the Galilean moons that were discovered, of course, by Galileo back in 1610. Those large moons are like planets. They have their own character. They have processes on the surface. They are fascinating in their own right. It is only in recent times that we have discovered that, and it is part of my own work to try and understand how those bodies, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, behave. And indeed, one of them is the second most popular suggested location for life elsewhere in the universe. Europa is a suggested location. Europa also figured prominently in Arthur C. Clarke's less well-known novel, 2010, because of the idea that there might be life beneath an ice shell in an ocean. And that, by the way, is an example of the interplay between science and science fiction, because Arthur C. Clarke was writing a science fiction story, but he did so knowing that scientists had made this suggestion already. So there was an interplay at the time that was written between scientists and the science fiction writer, in this case, Arthur C. Clarke.
Tell us about Juno, the upcoming mission to Jupiter.
We expect that Juno will be launched in 2010, and the purpose of that mission is to find out what the inside of Jupiter is like. And in particular, we would like to decide whether Jupiter has a core of material that is similar to Earth. And the reason why this is interesting is because we know that Jupiter is mostly hydrogen and therefore has a composition somewhat like the Sun. But if it has a core, then this is likely to tell us something about how Jupiter formed. And a popular idea in the scientific community is that you first made a core of material like the Earth and then put gas on top, thereby creating the planet we now see. Why does this matter? It matters because it's telling us something about how planets form. And Earth itself is affected by Jupiter. Jupiter is so massive that it affects the delivery of material to Earth, both at the time Earth formed and nowadays in the form of meteorites. So the solar system would be different. It would have behaved differently if Jupiter did not exist. So understanding how Jupiter formed is a crucial part of understanding the architecture of the solar system as a whole, including the nature of Earth, the planet we live on, whether we have water. All of these things are tied up with Jupiter. In the end, Jupiter matters so much because it is the 800-pound gorilla. It's the most massive planet in the solar system.
What are we finding out about solar systems and planets beyond our own?
We are finding that planets are common. The planets that are most easily found are like Jupiter, simply because they're so massive and so they have a gravitational effect. They cause a slight wobble in the position of the star in the sky, the star about which the planet is orbiting. And most of these planets have been discovered by that indirect method. It's called the Doppler method, the consequence of the gravitational influence, rather than directly seeing the planet. We are now seeing more examples of planets discovered by transit. Transit means that you look for the reduction in the starlight that arises because the planet comes between us and the star and obliterates some of the light from getting to Earth. And by this method, you can see how big the planet is, that is, what its radius is, as well as the mass. And there are now tens of examples of that kind, and we're going to get a lot more. So this is a very exciting period of science.
At the beginning of the interview, you talked about the role of imagination in scientific discovery. What has been the closest thing to a eureka moment for you?
It's difficult to answer a question like that. Certainly, there have been times when I have been very excited about something I'm doing in science. Maybe one of the things that I got excited about, perhaps it's a eureka moment, is the realization that there might be a way to go down inside Earth. Here I am, a planetary scientist, fascinated by what is out in space, and participating in this wonderful period we're going through where it has been possible to learn about planets by actually sending spacecraft there. And a natural question to ask, perhaps in analogy to the Jules Verne story, Journey to the Center of the Earth, is whether there is any way of going down. For indeed, there is a lot we don't know about the inside of the Earth. And planetary exploration has taught us that when you go somewhere, you are surprised. So I would expect that if we could go down into the Earth, we would be surprised. Many of our conceptions about what the inside of the Earth may be incorrect, not in the sense of enormous errors, but in the sense of surprises in the way things work and the composition of the material and so forth. So I did get to thinking about how you would go inside the Earth, and that is perhaps the craziest thing I've done, and it's unlikely to come to pass. It is too difficult technologically, but I did have the idea and presented it to the scientific community and the general public a few years ago of sending a probe, an unmanned probe, down into the interior of the Earth that might perhaps reach Earth's core and send back information. And the idea was based on cracking the solid rock in the Earth, filling that crack with liquid iron, and the liquid iron being heavy would open up the crack, and the crack would propagate down into the inside of the Earth, and then you would put a probe into that iron, and it would be carried down. I don't think this is going to happen, but the eureka moment, if you want to call it that, was the realization, not so much that this is possible, but that it deserves thinking about, because it has seemed to me that people don't even want to think about this. They've somehow already decided that it's impossible and ridiculous and not even worth attention. And I felt that it does deserve some attention, even though in the end we may decide that it's impractical.
One last question. Does your work with the planets and outer space make you more or less of a man of faith?
What sometimes happens when you are a scientist is that you see in the structure of the universe something that is mysterious and special about the way the universe is constructed. That might, in the minds of some, lead you to a religious perspective where you think about why it is that the universe has that particular form such that we could exist. Others would say that that's a circular argument. I have an open mind on that question. I do think, though, that for many scientists, the idea of a personal God is a strange one, the idea of a God that would answer to prayer. And so I think you find, and it has been noticed in surveys, that the existence of that kind of belief system is less common among scientists than among the general public. That doesn't mean, however, that scientists are so rigid in their thinking and so supposedly objective that they set aside any possibility of unanswered mysteries. In fact, scientists probably spend as much time thinking about the unanswered mysteries as people who are non-scientists. It's just that they come to it from a different perspective and might reach a different answer.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Stevenson. This was an incredibly interesting and absolutely fascinating conversation.
Well, thank you. I am delighted to have this opportunity to talk to you.
I've been talking to Dr. David Stevenson, George Van Osdell Professor of Planetary Science at Caltech. We continue with a play that is the embodiment of whimsical charm, The Undecided Molecule by Norman Corwin. Corwin is one of the legendary figures of broadcasting, and this first aired on July 17, 1945. The cast included Groucho Marx, Robert Benchley, Sylvia Sidney, and Vincent Price. You're about to sit in on the oddest trial in the history of jurisprudence. The defendant is a molecule which refuses to be assigned to any particular substance. It insists on choosing for itself. The story is told in verse, with off-kilter rhymes that recall the work of Ogden Nash. And now, take your seat, curtain going up, for The Undecided Molecule, starring Carl Reiner and Edward Asner.
The Court of Arbitrations and Adjudications of Physiochemical Relations, Department of the Interior of the Atom, Criminal Sitting, Division of Investigation, Charge, Countercharge, Accusation, and Confession is now in session. The court will rise and face the justice who will adjust this case. See that your concentration centers on His Honor the Justice just as he enters, which he is doing even now. Everybody bow, everybody bow.
Harumph, garumph, ahem, to wit, contrary notwithstanding, you may sit. Clerk, read the charge.
May it please the court at all to wit.
It pleases the court. Get on with it. Whose versus whom?
The cosmos and all the spheres, systems, clusters, galaxies, orbits, planets, satellites, together with all species of animals, vegetables, and minerals appertaining thereto, of all conditions of age, social standing, and sex, versus the anonymous molecule hereinafter referred to as X.
What's the charge against said molecule?
Unwilling to be named, rebelling when defined, declining to be blamed, objecting when assigned, protesting when selected, resisting an attack, refusing to be directed, and talking back.
Most serious, most dangerous, so strange, it's almost strangerous, insidious, precarious, a shade below nefarious. The possibilities in sight are frightful, meaning full of fright, and rueful, meaning full of rue, and gruesome, meaning rather grue.
Providing, Your Honor, the charges are true.
Why, yes, they must be proven true.
Which is something we have yet to do.
Quite right, but who was asking you? Now, is the prosecutor here?
Present.
Well, then appear, appear. The trial's on. Try not to miss it. Step up and state your case and be explicit.
May it please the court, this case involves a very small matter. By this, I don't mean mere trivia or idle chatter, but a particle of matter best described as little.
Smaller than a jot?
Even smaller than a tittle.
Are you referring to molecule X?
Yex.
Then why don't you say so?
I will if I may so. The point, Your Honor, is that should X be acquitted here, catastrophe will follow, since it must then be admitted here that all control of elements has given way to anarchy, and every substance will perforce be jittery and panicky. Thus, when we wish a molecule to join up with some others to make a cup or lemon drop or the Karamazov brothers, to be a fog or a catalogue or a lawn to be idyllic on, a beagle or a bagel or a mountain made of silicon, they may refrain, they may desist, and if enough of them should do so, there'll never be another tenor singer like Caruso. No dog to buck, no luck to huck, no grand old man like Talleyrand. No bee will be, you'll see, no sea. No ostrich fan for Sally Rand.
It's staggering. It's awesome. The damage X could wreak by simply playing possum. It makes me rather weak. Clerk, order me a pony of spirits of ammonia.
Now there you are. If X's rebellion is indulged, I think it only safe to say and fair to be divulged, there'll never be another atom of the element ammonium. So take that home and play it on Your Honor's own euphonium.
Young man, I blast at you a disapproving snort and warn you, one more phrase like that, grumph, contempt of court. Now, who is here for the defense?
I am, Your Honor.
Well, commence.
I will, I do so. Now you
see,
sir.
I see nothing of the sort. Who's paying you your fee, sir?
No one at all. The way it is with me, sir, I'm acting out of interest in civil liberty, sir.
What's liberty to do with it, if you will be so kind?
Just this. Where in the universal law books can you find it's criminal for anything to be of open mind?
The precedent is ample.
Is it? Let's have a sample.
Blackstone on the elements. Case of bismuth versus molybdenum.
Oh, drat the books. Our legal forebearers doubtlessly all fibbed in them.
Hold on there, you. Why, you upstart? Is not the horse before the cart? Where would we be without tradition?
In some advanced, improved position.
What? What? Young man, are you a red? Have you been to the crimson bread?
Neither to crimson nor to purple.
Well, no whippersnappering twirple. Challenge me. What do you take me for?
A most distinguished expert on the law.
First sensible thing you've said today. Where were we in this trial, by the way?
On the right of X to have an open mind. Now, surely justice is not yet so blind as to be unfavorably disposed.
Toward openness of mind, my mind is closed.
Your Honor, this is scandal. This...
Now, see here, I can handle this. Let's have no more of your bold to-do. A molecule must do what it is told to do. Now that's decided, suppose we break for lunch. I'm famished. Been a tiring day. I sure would like to crunch a nice fresh salad bowl of crispy, tangy hashish.
Your Honor, I cannot refrain from calling you a fascist.
Contempt of court, contempt of court. Clerk, find the counsel for defendant, please. He has the brass to charge the bench with having fascist tendencies. Ridiculous and ludicrous. Make it a heavy fine. How could I be a fascist? Why, I'm so benign. I hardly ever beat my wife. My children bow before me. I am much admired by rattlesnakes, and birds of prey adore me. I'm tender, and I'm sensitive, and anti-insurrectionist. I wouldn't hurt a cobra, and I'm anti-vivisectionist.
I'm sure that's absolutely true, and that you're not the sort who would deny a prisoner his right to speak in court. Your might is mixed with mercy, and wisdom's interfused. So how about a word or two from X, who is accused?
Oh, very well, since your appeal is to the better side of me, let no one say my conduct here is prejudiced or snide of me. We'll hear from X, but make it short. Where is the little dope?
Right here beneath the new electronic super microscope.
Swear him in.
Put your hand on the atomic table and say as loud as you are able, I do solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and buzz, fuzz, the muzzawalla, buzzawalla, hut, sut, flugle, boogle, putt, putt, scuttle, butt, and nothing but the truth. So help me I. Now testify.
What's that squeaking?
My client speaking.
Well, how do you expect me to understand?
There's an interpreter at hand.
Well, I don't see any.
Right off your elbow.
Oh, yes. How do you do?
I'm very well, Bo.
Bo? Aren't you getting a little bit famil?
I suppose I am, but please think nil of it.
Can you understand what the molecule says?
Yes. That's my business, isn't it?
A fey character.
Like in a film by Disney.
Disney's not involved in this.
Why isn't he?
I don't know. Where does this all lead?
Nowhere.
Then please proceed to interpret X for the court of Lex. Lex is Latin for law, I guess. Which shows I too enjoy access to more than one tongue. I am a giant intellect. Now, let's hear from your client.
Proceed, if you will, Mr. Molecule. Let your story fairly leap from you. Come on. Come on, we're waiting now. The court wants to hear a peep from you.
X says as follows. I cannot bring myself to be just anything that's asked of me. I cannot chide my inner soul. I must confide. I've set a goal. I've thought it through and cannot bear to be shampoo for oily hair. My spirit sings, my fiber spiels of nobler things and high ideals. I'll fairly bust my heart within if I am just an onion skin. I worry some. What's drearier than to become bacteria? And when I tried hard to obey, my conscience cried, but hold, but stay. A worm for bait? I have my pride. I vacillate. I can't decide. Though Hamlet had a hard time, why, he wasn't so sad as little I. You see my lot, it's not for me to be or not, but what to be. My plight inside is bona fide. I can't decide. I can't decide.
I've never been so touched or moved. I sniffle and I blubber. I thought my heart was made of steel, but it is made of rubber. Poor little thing, tormented so by dreams of the eugenic.
Oh, fiddlesticks! This molecule is but a schizophrenic. How is it that in all the time since matter first appeared, each separate iota has loyally adhered to universal law without a solitary beef until this pipsqueak came along? Now suddenly there's grief. The heavens shake, and earthquakes quake, and oceans heave and slither, and dogs and cats and acrobats are in a frightful dither. A timid snip has lost its grip in whines of its neurosis. If you condone this freak, you'll reek of moral halitosis. I strongly urge your honor, purge X to its smallest decibel. Or else the infinite will bow before the infinitesimal.
You're right. What was I thinking of to pity yon schlemiel? I thought my heart was fairly soft, but it is made of steel. I shall not spoil this molecule by sparing at the rod, and so I sentence it to die before a firing squad. Perhaps a little torture first, like singeing at the stake and drops of water on the head, and for variety's sake, a little twist of the garrote, a slice of guillotine, and X shall mark the spot where X was boiled in Vaseline.
I ask the sentence be appealed.
Impossible! Your client's fate is sealed.
No, the court's decision is far from ineluctable. I must remind you, my good sir, that matter's indestructible.
Gadzooks, it is. I had forgot. We can't destroy a particle. It seems we're in the power of this clever young upstartical.
The case is lost. I must withdraw. If punishment's not capital, and X cannot be executed, I don't give a rap at all. We can't imprison it, for we'd be in a most infernal stew, with cosmic checks and balances eternally askew.
Oh, dear, Vesemir, Vesemir. What will become of all of us? This little jerk and his strange quirk will surely be the fall of us.
Would it be cheek to ask to speak to you as mensch to mensch? I mean, could all of us just call a meeting at the bench?
Ordinarily, I would not so choose. But after all, what is there to lose?
May I suggest a means by which disaster be evaded? My client is no pighead and may likely be persuaded to join some element or other. X is not a softy. It merely wishes to belong to something fairly lofty. Its point of view is forward, its attitude is global. Its heart is set on being part of something good and noble. So I suggest you demonstrate, and this will never hurt you, that being this or that or t'other has a point of virtue.
Well, how do you propose we do it?
I have a plan, and I was coming to it. Invite a representative of each important kingdom.
You mean like Dempsey for the ring or Artishaw for swingdom?
No, but you're warm.
A lion for the jungle or an eagle for all wingdom?
Keep on. Remember, three of them and one for every kingdom.
Oh, I know. Animal and mineral. And I forget the third.
The vegetable kingdom.
Let's bring them.
Why, yes, of course. That's splendid. We could get them here and each could make a pitch. And X could then make up its mind to which it wished to hitch. I'll call a recess in this trial while we round up a trio. And meanwhile, some music. Clerk!
Yes, sir.
Can you sound solo mio?
No, Your Honor. I'm in a bind because my tonsils are on a line.
Then never mind.
Don't the court musicians surely know some good wind music, blow by blow?
Maybe the Schnorrer's Chorus from Peer Gynt?
Or Fandango for the Fanny by Larry Flint?
Oh, whatever you play, don't make a mess of this minuscule recess.
The spokesman for the vegetable kingdom will rise and address the court concerning the advantages to molecule X of joining this classification with handy allusions to paleontology, plant psychology, stems and flowers, roots and fruits, and outstanding examples of horticulture and botany, if he's got any.
I doubt that X will ever see an atom lovely as a tree. Why, nothing has got quite the charm of the most ordinary palm. We've coffee beans and turpentine and grapes that make imported wine. And as for moles and types of fungus, we have some noted ones among us. Penicillin is a spore noble beyond metaphor. Should a kidney become stony, calm it down with macaroni. Today it's smart and even faddish to ingest quantities of radish. If one's goal is pleasing women, forget Viagra, eat persimmon. Life is earnest, life is sweet, for the common sugar beet. Cotton, spinach, hemp, and hop, one could really never stop singing vegetary praise for years and months and weeks and days and...
X says that trees are chopped for wood, and that he sees no special good in being a beet which people eat. X says a palm, though fine and main, can come to harm in a hurricane. The grape's a curse, since drink is evil, and cotton is worse for the boll weevil. X does not wish to look for trouble. It's not his dish, the vegetable.
For a molecule that's supposed to be meek, this choosy Mr. X has a lot of cheek. Step down, vegetable. Let minerals speak.
The spokesman for the mineral kingdom will address the court concerning the advantages to molecule X of joining this classification with allusions to metallurgy, gypsum, filiform silver, motor cars, nickel bars, pickle jaws, and manganese. Please.
Now, the way that X can best ensure his choice of substance will endure is to stop his flopping about and settle down to being a respectable metal. Oh, fiddle-dee-dee and fiddle-dee-dum, yum-yum, oh boy, aluminum. If he likes the works of Byron, he can be the iron in irony.
That sounds to me like pure unalloyed non sequitur.
Yes. If he wishes to be a worker, he can serve in a column of mercury. If he'd rather be gay and giddysome, there's radium, uranium, iridium. Oh, tantalum, tungsten, talcum, tin, ipsy, pipsy, bitters of gin, alto sax and carpet tax, rackety, racks, borax, borax, merrily, berrily, calibite, chin, tripolite, zinc, and kaolin.
Are these football yells necessary?
Yes, sir, very.
What do they mean?
Well, amphibole, sphene, and pyroxene, being amygdaloidally idiochromatic, may create a stalactitic static affecting the scalenohedronal speed.
That clears it up very well indeed. Proceed.
If X wants glamour, need he be told of silver, platinum, and gold? And the safest job on any planet is to be a nice, strong rock of granite. If he likes good cooking, a dinner'll boil very nicely over mineral oil. Does he cry to be a wagon hitched to a star? Then apply to be a Hollywood motor car. Oh, I could pour mineral lore before you forever and a day, if it wouldn't bore you.
X says he, that any jury'll find mercury somewhat mercurial. Iron gets rusty, bare rock's too nude. Talc is too dusty, oil is crude. The automobile is not as bent. One elliptical wheel means an accident. Gold you can keep, he simply balks at lying deep beneath Fort Knox.
I've never heard such utterly rash, hypocritical balderdash. If I weren't so stately and dignified, I'd take that molecule outside and bop him right on his little beezer. Who does he think he is, Little Caesar? Rawr, let the animal kingdom present its spokesman. Come on, where is the gent?
Right here, but your honor...
All right, begin.
Well, it's a her.
Never mind, swear him in.
The spokesman for the animal kingdom, etc., species of the bird, bee, dog, flea, hen, men, does solemnly swear, etc., in the name of llama, gnu, ark, yak, kangaroo, slippery Dan, Charlie Chan, the common man, and so forth, that he or she will please go forth and testify to the legal core.
Thank you. I gladly take the floor.
Rather pretty. Eh bien, alors.
I could fascinate X with the mystery of our considerable natural history and tell him the fame of each colorful name.
Go on, I'm goose pimply and blistery.
I could tell of a bird named the Smew and another Yclept Urubu, of the Zigatai Zoe and of Zingle Row.
And a fish that is called Incanu?
Quite true.
And a monkey that's called Wanderloo?
Quite true.
Oh, I just love to listen to you.
I could tell of the vinegaroo, the squacco, the guiduck, the baboon, the antelope bongo, the crow known as Drongo.
Will you join me at lunch one day soon?
For the record, may I ask whether these names are real or fictionary?
Don't interrupt. They're all in your dictionary.
Now, the capercaillie has a whistle, distinct from the ling and dixissel, the zebu and zevet and terek of Tibet.
I cling to your words like a thistle.
I urge X to join the toucan or some other nice animal clan, like the beautiful cootie or the charming agouti.
But what about the species of man?
Oh, that's another subject entirely. I do not recommend that X get involved in the affairs of mankind.
Is that because you believe in the principle of matter over man's mind?
No. But being human would surely vex a sensitive molecule like X.
Just how do you mean, Queen?
Well, it's not so easy to be a common man. No matter how much you work and plan, it's still a neat trick to live the span commonly allotted to the common man. A wandering breeze will affect your pump. If not a measle, then a mump. You can pull a tendon, get roundly hissed, or have to depend on an analyst. You can get ptomaine or be undersold, then there's rain in Spain and the common cold. A review can stink. You can miss a guess or be told how to think by the yellow press.
Did I tell you I greatly admire your dress?
There's water on the knee and athlete's toes, the doctor's fee and the running nose, aching bursitises, rashes and rickets, colitis and worse itises, and parking tickets.
Not in this court.
You can get diabetes or caught in the rain. You can run out of Wheaties or into a train.
Not in this court.
You can get neurasthenia. A blizzard can chill you. Your wife can be menia. A dentist drill you. A plaintiff can sue you. A bite give malaria. If no lover woo you, alas, miseraria.
Ray, legal embroilments, just let me take care of you.
A landlord will fight you. And then there is asthma. Vampires can bite you and whine on your plasma. You can be badly reared and flunk out in Latin, or tangle your beard in spaghetti au gratin. You can get a flat tire, drop teeth in the drain, or suffer a dire escutcheon stain. You can drown in the Dnieper, or suffer the bends. You can wind up a leper and lose all your friends. You can settle in Philly, or step in a pail, or feel willy-nilly and cease to inhale.
How morbid, depressing, in fact, suicidal. By the way, have you ever an hour that's idle?
Your Honor, my client has something to say.
I could meet you. What about that ex again, eh?
He's ready, I said.
Well, let him go ahead.
X says as follows. I'm glad to know the awful truth. Man has such woe, forsooth. Forsooth. Yet what he's done, proud hands can clap. He invented the pun and beer on tap. He flies the air just like the smew and swims for fair like the inconnu. He has a soul, he reads Descartes. He makes a goal of being smart. He's learned to kill the harmful bug by serum, pill, and high-priced drug. He beats the band and goes to school to understand the molecule. In face of odds, he makes his way, gives birth to quads, builds TVA, displays his charms, plays blindfold chess, listens to Brahms and PBS. The common guy both thinks and feels. Nothing's too high for his ideals. Though it cost him sadly to put down jerks, he's not done badly. Look at his works. For all his pains, we owe him thanks, and I do gladly join his ranks. The human flock has golden fleece, grace to its stock, and lasting peace.
Oh, splendid! What a moving speech! I had thought X a worm, a leech, but now I see he's a regular fellow. He's twanged me so I quiver like jello. Oh, joy! Oh, rapture! Fields of clover!
Looks to me like the trial is over.
Quite so! My dear X, forgive the digression, but I'm sure you'll be happy in your chosen profession. As for you, Miss Anima, you're great. It's slightly extra legal, but have you a date for later in the evening? Do you like to dance? Have you any marked tendency toward romance?
Oh, I have. But what about the wife you seldom beat and the children you have mentioned who grovel at your feet?
Oh, mere rhetoric and figmentary frippery. The legal mind behaves this way. It's very smooth and slippery when arguing. I have no wife or any such a fixture.
In that case, I will marry you, as in a Class B picture. We'll create a happy ending plus two children of each sex.
To be part of one of them, shall we invite Friend X?
Magnificent idea, that. Is our future child agreed?
X says, indeed, and asks you speed your visit to the Reverend so he can have a life to lead and bring this to a clever end.
Hooray! I thought you'd never end. Will the court musicians kindly advance to the mic and play your wedding dance? And then after that, please segue and sally into a sort of a kind of finale. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Undecided Molecule, starring, in alphabetical order, Edward Asner as the prosecutor, Jack Delson as the vegetable spokesman, Ari Gross as the defense counsel, Daniel Passer as the interpreter, Elliot Reed as the mineral spokesman, Carl Reiner as the judge, Charles Robinson as the clerk, and Erica Schickel as Anima. Produced for radio by Raymond Guarna. The Undecided Molecule was written and directed by Norman Corwin and produced in association with the Museum of Television and Radio, Los Angeles. There's an interesting connection between the two broadcasting legends whose work we have celebrated in this program. On October 31st, 1938, Norman Corwin was in the studios of CBS rehearsing the pilot for his new show, Words and Music. On the floor below, Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the Air were broadcasting War of the Worlds. Corwin was oblivious to the furor erupting across America. Then the overloaded CBS switchboard somehow routed a call to his control room. He tells the following story. I took the call, and it was a man, very excited, with a gravelly voice and a thick New York accent. He said, "Is this the station that broadcast that program about the Mars invasion?" I said it was, and the man erupted. "I just wanted you to know that my wife heard that program, and she got so excited she ran outside and fell down a whole flight of stairs." I was horrified and started to say something, but the man went right on, appreciatively. "Geez, what a wonderful program!" And he hung up. I'm Susan Lowenberg, producing director of LA Theater Works, and you're listening to a special presentation of The Play's the Thing, as part of the Relativity series, funded in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology. You can download this program from the KPCC website for 3 months, beginning May 5th. Go to kpcc.org and click on Podcasts. The Relativity series continues next month with Atomic Bombers by Russell Vandenbroek, which takes an offbeat look at the Manhattan Project and the race to build the first atomic bomb. Join us next week for Shadowlands, William Nicholson's award-winning play about the author of the Narnia Chronicles, C.S. Lewis. Martin Jarvis stars as the shy Oxford Don and Harriet Harris as the American poet Joy Gresham in a story of love and loss that transformed Lewis's life and his faith. That's Shadowlands, next time on The Play's the Thing. I'm Susan Lowenberg. Thanks for joining us.
This is a production of LA Theater Works. Major support for the production of plays in our current live performance season is provided by the Peter Glenville Foundation. Additional support for LA Theater Works productions and programs is provided by the Capital Group Company's Charitable Foundation and the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors through the Los Angeles County Arts Commission. To purchase a copy of this production or to receive a catalog of LA Theater Works plays, musicals, and novels, please call 1-800-708-8863 within the U.S. or visit our website, latw.org. Email your comments or suggestions to latw@latw.org. The Beverly Hilton Hotel is the official hotel of The Play's the Thing. Brendan Fox is the associate producer. Susan Albert Lowenberg is the executive producer. Recording, editing, and mixing engineer, Dennis Contreras at Voicebox Studios. The Play's the Thing radio series is produced by Mark Ward.